KZSU Stanford, 90.1 FM. I'm Mark Molino. This is the Henry George Program, show all about land, policy, and politics. Today in the program, we have on Mark William Palin, historian and author of Pax Economica, Left-Wing Visions of a Free Trade World, a history of free trade and left-wing thought in the 19th and 20th centuries, examining tendencies such as pacifists, Georgists, and examining the rise of international structures such as the United Nations, and the foundering of much of this ideology in the wake of the Cold War and neoliberalism. So plenty to talk about with this. So without further ado, let's just get into it. So Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So the book is Pax Economica, Left-Wing Visions of a Free Trade World. A very interesting book that I think is a history of ideology. It's a very thorough and dense survey of 100 or so years of kind of the pre-World War II order and then after. So I guess before we get into it, so what exactly was the motivation? What kind of brought you into this world in the first place?
It was two things. It was my engagement with and interest in this growing literature on free trade internationalism, but so much of it has been focused on sort of right-wing origin stories of, you know, quote-unquote neoliberalism, the Friedrich Hayeks and the Milton Friedmans, and the way that they've helped shape the institutions and Western political and economic programs since, say, the 1970s, 1980s, and beyond. And I found that literature very fascinating, but it kind of ran at odds with what I was finding when I was doing research on the first book. And then when I was starting to kind of peek in the archives past the 1890s, when I was looking forward to the First World War, I started finding these free trade organizations in, say, Boston and New York and Geneva, like the International Free Trade League in Boston that was founded during the First World War. And I was looking at the officer list. It was this really international list of membership, but it was also a who's who of women suffragists, socialist internationalists, Henry Georgists. And they were working together and dedicated towards, I mean, it was very much a peace organization. And so it was this connection between peace and anti-imperialism and free trade that I found fascinating, but it was also the left-wing subscribers to it that I was finding on those lists and that mapped onto the stuff I'd seen from the late 19th century as well, that I thought that this would be a really fascinating way to tell a very different history of the rise of, you know, modern economic liberalism, this left-wing story that I think in many ways is far richer and far more interesting and robust than that kind of right-wing story that maybe we're more familiar with.
Yes, it's interesting that the general status quo of kind of the Thatcher, Reagan, free trade, you know, believers, you know, essentially kind of ran out of steam in the last several decades, especially in the wave of kind of the new economic populists of the right. I mean, and it's kind of staggering how quickly it is. It was very funny in the news to see that Trump before, not only talking about, you know, you'd see his rhetoric in the past be like, oh, we have deals, but those are bad deals. Now he's very full-throatedly talking about, one, tariffs are a good idea, and two, you need to study the administration of McKinley, which is like, that was not on my top guesses of what I'd hear him talk about. You need to study anytime soon. It's pretty wild stuff.
I mean, you know, the McKinley tariff is my bread and butter. So I cut my teeth in the first book on that. So I was, you know, in a weird way, pleasantly surprised to see McKinley get a shout out here. But it is very strange, the kind of late 19th, early 20th century protectionist understandings of global economics that the Trump administration had and apparently still has. Yeah, I mean, they were, even before that, they were referencing Teddy Roosevelt's speech where he was calling for Republican-style reciprocity towards Cuba in the early 1900s. And this was all tied into these kind of earlier turn-of-the-century debates around protectionism and American expansionism. Again, yeah, the obsession here with late 19th, early 20th century global protectionist politics is just absolutely bizarre to be coming back in 2024.
Yeah, I at least get there's a cult of personality around Teddy Roosevelt, but like McKinley is not the most charismatic figure. So it's pretty wild. I mean, do you see this as being like, should we study the 19th century because we're going to be returning to it? Or what do you see as the difference between kind of the return to these policies now? Because nothing is ever the same twice. And you can't really return to that same old politics. Maybe describe late 19th century GOP protectionist. Do you see this as being something that they, you know, that can return, you know, full hog?
Yeah, I mean, and I think you're right too to have that kind of caveat that nothing's going to be quite the same. Obviously, the global economic order now is very different from what it looked like in the late 19th, early 20th century, or in the interwar years between. I do wonder actually with this rhetorical shift and the way that they're even talking about trade politics in a very kind of 1890s, early 1900s way now, if this is going to push the debate. I feel like much of the debate right now is how much is this like the 1920s or the 1930s? How much does this align with kind of the resurgent, the upsurge of fascism alongside the Great Depression? I wonder if we're maybe it's better at this point to be looking for parallels, since they're making it so explicit, to connections there with the GOP's protectionist response to the Long Depression of the late 19th century, and the kind of illiberal turn of politics that brought is maybe, or I can see that as maybe being a place for debate amongst historians, at least, of globalization. Is this more like the late 19th century or more like the interwar years that we're seeing a return to at this point? Thinking about the GOP's protectionism, something else that I think has been largely forgotten. It was something ever since Trump started running in 2016. And again, using that rhetoric of the Gilded Age and progressive era, I was trying to remind people that this was not some sort of aberration, that the GOP's embrace of free trade from Reagan, I suppose, onwards, is that's the exception to the rule. And if you look at the longer history of the GOP, it is the party of protectionism. It's the party of big business. We focus on the kind of ideological subscription of the Republican Party upon its founding to anti-slavery principles, which is accurate, but lying very close behind that, the surface there was their adherence to, at least the majority adherence to economic nationalism along the lines of Frederick List, Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay, right? Lincoln as a disciple of this Whig tradition of Henry Clay, the American system of protectionism, subsidies for internal improvements and businesses and doling out lands to spark Western expansion, as well as high protective tariffs to help nurse America's infant industries. This is what the Republican Party stood for, especially once slavery came to an end in 1865. It really rebrands itself, refashions itself as the party of protectionism. William McKinley, of course, becoming sort of the figurehead of this in the halls of Congress when he became known as the Napoleon of Protection. The little guy who became the mouthpiece of the protectionists in Congress. I think that story, that longer history of Republican protectionism is one of the things that I try to tease out here and show the resonances of the longer term resonances of it, also the way that it helps shape America's economic expansionism, its imperial expansionism.
Yeah, as far as like the ideological background or kind of the battle lines of this, they're not names that people turn to that often these days, of List versus Cobden. And I think, I think people know Cobden, as a historical figure. But the fact that like there were people with the anti-Cobden leagues, pro-List, people were really getting into this. And I guess, all these figures from Cobden going on to Norman Angel. And I guess these are figures that you wouldn't think perhaps would inspire, leagues, communities, people really, really kind of putting their souls into it and believing in it. But I guess to start with, List, there was that factoid in the different book, How Asia Works, about how a lot of these kind of developing Asian thought leaders or so on, they would have shelves of List, who was almost a completely forgotten figure in the West at that point. But why don't you speak a bit about the explicit imperial and colonial aspects of kind of the List project as it was?
Yeah, so he writes his magnum opus after he in the early 1800s, published in 1841, National System of Political Economy. And he does it after he's born in Germany, ends up moving to the United States in the 1820s, and spends enough time there where he became an American citizen. And at that point, he kind of becomes embroiled in early 19th century American protectionist politics in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was sort of the center of protectionist intellectual thought at that point, and you know, the railroad building and all this kind of stuff. And so, in many ways, he draws on this kind of American system of protectionism to help inform his own kind of updating of those ideas for an increasingly globalized economy. And in part, as a response to Britain's embrace of free trade in 1846 when it overturns the Corn Laws. And so he's seeing that liberal economic turn in Britain. And so he's bringing these American system ideas back with him when he comes back to Germany in the 1830s, where he kind of creates this what becomes known as the German historical school, that becomes essentially dominates the German academy in the late 19th century, at a point when the German academy was extremely influential, not just on kind of international students from the United States and elsewhere coming to study and bringing back these ideas with them, but also the way that they influenced German imperial politics. And that's where Liszt, I think, is really fascinating here, because he's, in a certain sense, an anti-imperialist, the way he sees his protectionist prescription, right? So when he's writing in the 1840s, he's seeing this as the rival empires of Britain need to embrace protectionist politics to help solidify the nation state and help nurse its infant industries against the more industrialized British. So in that sense, it's sort of an anti-imperial project of protectionism to thwart the imperial free trade machinations of the British.
It's
But
multipolar, at least. That's
it's interesting too. Maybe we can get to that anti-imperial aspect, which is really fascinating too, that comes into
yeah.
play in certain kind of anti-colonial context. And I think in many ways is maybe the more important in shaping the kind of the global South embrace of listing ideas today in a much less explicitly imperial dimension. Although again, maybe the Trumpian element of that is bringing back the imperial dimensions too. Yeah, he's very, I mean, Liszt is very explicit in there. He not only is he saying that this is an anti-imperial or a way to kind of thwart the imperial machinations of the British, but he says there very explicitly in that book that the United States, France, Germany, these rival industrializing imperial powers of the British need to expand their colonies as well. And he really creates a world in which this sort of colonial system in which these Western imperial powers colonize the rest of the world, the tropical states that he sees as you know, indolent and uncivilized and essentially a perpetual state of colonial exploitation by the West with the rest, that I think is this is extremely influential on imperial thinkers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, to your point here too about the way that this resonates and how Liszt ends up on all these bookshelves. And you know, you got the Frederick Liszt of the Imperial Russia by the 1890s, Vitae and so forth. I mean, it's very explicit. And that's one of the things I tried to do here is draw out the explicit connections between Liszt's ideas with the imperial politicians and intellectuals of the time who were so influential in creating these imperial projects and debates and advocating for it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you're talking about the influences and the kind of, post-colonial, developing world. And I guess in the 19th century context, that was not really even part of the discussion, as far as like what is developing country. It seems like it was mostly about the leaders of the pack and the people who were the also-rans trying to catch up. And, Liszt was, essentially saying that everyone who's trying to keep up with Britain, they had to have their own colonial appendage to I suppose there's, two aspects to what drove that, you say, which is, both it's the ability to expend surplus capital, but just to get resources. He wasn't talking about complete autarky. He was, most places in the world need raw resources, so just run some colonies. That's the I guess the most straightforward way to get it. If you're talking about the developing world, a lot of it has to go with the fact that if you can't beat them, join them. It's they are going to be colonized. At the very least, they can at least try to join this kind of competitive field of different states, each with their kind of ability to dominate others. And, you know, I think if you talk about the different forces that seem to make all these different imperial wars inevitable, you know, a lot of it is downstream of this kind of Listian ideology.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, and I guess in one sense, if you're going to think about the developing world in that sense in the late 19th century, it's the rival imperial powers. It's the French, the Germans, and the United States, I think, that would fit that sure. model, at least in List mind. And then it's the subsequent developing world of the 20th century that's coming into being or trying to join that project that drives some of these anti-colonial nationalists, like in India, that want to resuscitate Indian industries that have been kind of choked out by the imperial enforcement of free trade by the British. And so you have some in those contexts where you have that Listian anti-colonial aspect that's starting to show itself even in the early 1900s. But as you're pointing out, in a much bigger way after 1945, these developmentalist ideas of economic nationalism as a way to catch up to the West after decades, or if not even centuries, of colonial exploitation. That's in their minds, and rightly so. If you take this Listian model, their industrial development had not been allowed to progress as a result of this colonial exploitation that List had laid out so clearly, as you said, with yes, exporting surplus capital from the imperial metropoles, but also using these colonies as sources of agricultural and raw material exploitation to bring back to the metropole to be used by the industrial core.
And I think this introduces some of the dynamics of you might say kind of like the realist versus the idealist. Now, I wouldn't say that the left wing, as described in this book, are all utopian idealists, but there is some aspects of that. I think you might say that the kind of Listian idea that there is no kind of moral background, it's just kind of peoples versus peoples, dog eat dog. But and it's kind of interesting, like, to see how this is pushed back on by some by saying, like, well, that's not fair. For instance, you can always be kind of, you know, left behind and kind of criticize the First World as it was for having unfair trade. You know, this was, you know, kind of a closed door to many. And I think it's like, you know, some people would try to have it, you know, both ways, as it were, like Nehru, who would say that, you know, Britain is imposing a very kind of one-sided trade, but saying that we should also be able to perhaps be, you know, one-sided or kind of to develop in our own way, but I think Britain should play fairer or something. And I guess I suppose, you know, if in this context, if they're kind of appealing to the ref, as it was, what are you doing? Is this, you know, is this kind of appealing to some greater, you know, kind of moral sense? You know, there isn't really a supranational entity that really can speak to this. People are trying to develop this bit by bit, but at this point, you know, there is no sort of supranational system that, you know, except for the one that people are grasping towards.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, obviously this changes quite a bit once we get to the League of Nations period, and then even more so once we get to the United Nations period, in really fascinating ways too, that surprised me when I was writing about those particular sections. But yeah, if we're sticking to the late 19th, early 20th centuries, they aren't dealing with these supranational structures, and they don't have those League of Nations and so forth to help further their national causes for independence or self-rule, however you want to describe it. That of course changes quite a bit over this period as well. But yeah, the leading nationalists, for the most part, in places like India, and I mean, I think this is maybe one of the points that I try to make here too, is that we have to understand the protectionist makeup of the late 19th, early 20th century, that for too long, I think, and you find this in all sorts of scholarship, it's become ingrained in many ways. If you read international relations scholarship, economic histories, as well as histories from the field of history, describing the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the decades leading up to the First World War, as a period of free trade and laissez-faire run amok. I think it works nicely. I think, and it's probably one of the reasons why people are drawn to it. It makes a nice juxtaposition to the turn towards self-sufficiency and inward-lookingness of the 1920s and 30s. But from the left-wing internationalist perspective that I draw out here, that is not how they understood this period. So Norman Angel, who you mentioned, right, who has this kind of Norman Angel societies for a time and all over Europe and the United States and even Japan, you know, he is another one of these who's been misunderstood when he wrote The Great Illusion in 1910. He's sort of an early 1900s Cobdenite in Britain, a journalist, and he's often portrayed, I think wrongly, as somebody who is saying that the world had become so interdependent through free trade and all this kind of stuff that war was obsolete, that war couldn't happen. And that he was proven so terribly wrong then when suddenly the First World War broke out a handful of years later after he wrote this book. What if you actually look at The Great Illusion, he spent a lot of his years later actually trying to correct this misinterpretation. He was saying that the world had become so interdependent by around 1910 that nobody would win from war, that even the so-called winners of wars would end up losing because of the drastic effects it would have on global trade and the fact that, you know, countries were increasingly dependent on it despite the growing protectionist policies and the economic nationalism accompanied by the political nationalism. So in many ways, he was saying he was seeing these nationalistic trends, both economic and political and ethnic, and foreseeing the dangers of a war, potentially a world war even, and trying to warn businessmen to take heed that this is not going to be good for anybody. So it's a more pessimistic look, but it's also one that I think drives home the fact that they saw the world as a protectionist world order. Britain was the exception to the protectionist rule throughout this period, and it's been distorted over the years in many ways, at least as far as I've come across it. And so one of the things I've tried to do in this book is to correct that misimpression, to bring back the way that these not just the left-wing internationalists, but the economic nationalist realists, as you put it, also understood it. That, you know, the difference was is that the realists kind of saw this as just the state of affairs, and this is how the world was forever going to be: trade wars and so forth, dog eat dog, beggar thy neighbor politics. Again, very reminiscent of how Trump is talking about the global economic order as he sees it today and or wants to see it. And so that rhetoric is there, that realism. Yeah, like you said too, is this really idealism? Of course, the left-wing internationalists of the book wouldn't see themselves as idealists. Idealists, I suppose, in the sense that they want something other than what we have, but not an idealist in the sense that they wanted something that, as far as they were concerned, was an impossibility. That they thought this was very much something that was in reach. It just had to take, well, in some cases, reform on the very far end of the left-wing spectrum. It would require maybe revolution as well.
Yeah, as far as the you know, Angel pushing back on that war is catastrophic. I mean, I suppose the idea still being active at that time that what is war? The Franco-Prussian War, for instance, is like, that was a war that was, you know, it was certainly not clean. It caused a lot of misery, but it was a clear winner who walked away saying, yeah, that was pretty nice. You know, I got a lot of money out of it or so on. But I don't know. And I guess it wasn't, I mean, and there's still like even pushing back on kind of a clean war of conquest. It's, you know, the folks pushing for the Kellogg-Briand Act in the late 20s or so. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think the idea like maybe that war doesn't have winners is, you know, a more modern notion than people perhaps keep in mind. And I think there's some folks that have always been pacifists, but I don't know. A lot of times that wasn't the case.
Yeah, and there might be a bit of a naivete into that argument that Angel is making. And of course, he had to admit later that he didn't feel like he got it entirely right. You know, he was trying to make a pragmatic appeal to the businessman's pocketbook, rather than go after the idealistic highbrow element of the argument. He was just trying to say this is going to be bad for businesses. He did have to subsequently update that after the First World War to say, except for the munitions makers, of course.
Sure.
So this, what we now would think of as the military industrial complex, obviously there are now businesses that we recognize do win, so to speak, from wars, even if nations themselves, it might not be quite so noticeable who's winning and losing from it nowadays. But I mean, I guess it ties into that argument that we, interdependence theory or capitalist peace theory, though, right? This is the idea of not that just that war is inefficient and bad and perhaps taken to an extreme, the ultimate protectionist policy, because it usually leads to embargoes and so forth. And of course, the ships themselves being under attack. But it ties into this, you know, what I would say is a mid-19th century origins of capitalist peace theory, the idea that it's far less likely that countries will go to war with one another if they are trading partners. And you know, why would you go to war with trading rights? So the more that you can increase global trade and trade between nations, the less likely you're making it for wars to break out. Not to say that it won't or can't, and of course that takes into account kind of the irrationalism sometimes of politics and nationalism that transcends these kind of pragmatic understandings of how the world order should work. But so this I think that this question about war and peace ties in directly though to these debates that they're having around free trade and protectionism from around the time of List and Cobden, and continues onwards as we see with Norman Angell and beyond.
So back on the topic of kind of the left-wing aspects and their idealism, give or take, I'd say that you look at several different perspectives of the left wing. A lot of them would be kind of just the kind of left-wing internationalism of Cobden and Angell and Henry George would fit in this as well. You talk about kind of the Marxist influences both before and after the Soviet bloc comes to pass. You have a feminist perspective, and you talk about also the religious order. And a lot of these kind of, I think, have overlap to some degree. You talk about Cobden. I mean, I haven't really read much of Cobden in the original, but just from quotes, he worked heavily with, he had a Quaker close colleague. And it seems like the fervor of his statements really have a religious zeal to them. And I can definitely speak from experience in reading that Henry George, I would say, was very much influenced by religion, was almost a religious writer in that sense. So I think you can maybe compare and contrast this to, again, kind of the late 20th century Reagan, Thatcher, neoliberal wing. There is a bloodlessness about free trade is good, free trade will make you rich, but it's very rare that you see perhaps that same moral perspective feed into that. And that coming from, Reagan was not unwilling to talk about, kind of the morality of American as a Christian nation, but with free trade, that was a much more bloodless, whereas the 19th century reformers, I think there was just, you can definitely see much more of this moral component that fed into everything.
I mean, you're absolutely right. Yeah. And Richard Cobden, who is the kind of middle-class leader of this pressure group, this free trade pressure group in Britain in the late 1830s, early 1840s, called the Anti-Corn Law League. The corn laws being these protective tariffs on foreign grain that Britain had to something that the aristocratic landed elites supported, but that was raising prices on food. This is the kind of milieu that Cobden found himself in. But yeah, he was. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things I had, when I was thinking about how to structure this book in certain ways. It made sense to look at the Christian side of this story separately, but in many ways you're absolutely right. Each of the chapters, there's a lot of overlap. Even the same people show up. I try to make them show up though within slightly different context, right?
So sure.
The socialist element there, but also some of those socialist free traders show up in the Christian section, but much more within the kind of context of the Christian aspects of the movement rather than the socialist aspects. But they are very intertwined. And Cobden himself was very explicit about this, the way he was explicitly using religious language, it tapped into this millenarian spirit of the mid-19th century. This dawning of this new age of globalization that we now think of as modern globalization, right? Transcontinental railways were soon to be developed, and steamship lines, and transatlantic cables, and so the world was connecting in ways that they'd never seen. And then when Britain turns to free trade, this also seemed to be ushering in a new millenarian era that Christian internationalist peace activists, especially on the left, thought was a sign from God that they were finally embracing the world as God designed it, right? The peaceable exchange of products spread around the world in ways that would create a more socially equitable world. And so he's very explicit about this, and so are his subsequent disciples. I mean, one of the fascinating things about that too that I found was amongst all the groups that I look at, like you said, the liberal radicals, the socialist internationalists, the feminists, and then the Christians. It's most noticeable in the post-1945 period that it's within the Christian wing of this movement that you start to see the biggest cracks showing. The people who turn away from the left and embrace the right when it comes to free trade, and they even start using slightly different terminology. They start referring to it as free enterprise instead of free trade. And increasingly, though, too, disconnecting their advocacy of free trade with world peace and anti-imperialism, and increasingly just about profits and in defense of kind of Western capitalism within the milieu of the Cold War. So it's the Christian aspect also that feeds into this split of the Christian left wing free traders to join the kind of right wing Reagan Thatcher moment of the 70s and 80s is another part of the story that I didn't expect to find, but I think it was very much there.
Yeah, the structure of the book, you know, is really about the rise to this new order and then the crack up. And you see that's kind of the structure you have again and again. And the figure that comes in each time is really Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State under FDR for almost all of his time in office, which I had no idea about his background as a real believer in Cobden. You know, it seems almost, you know, unusual at that point in time, you know, that he would be such a true believer in this figure who is, you know, over 100 years past his birth by that point. But insofar as the post-World War II order, you know, kind of leading up to the Marshall Plan, all the reciprocal trade agreements, and, you know, the rise of the UN, that you can see this as coming out of, you know, as far as an ideological foundation of Cobdenism, which I think, as far as, you know, trade deals, I think that, you know, we perhaps jump to kind of what has happened in the Cold War and the rise of neoliberalism, as opposed to kind of what it was seen as at this time of, you know, kind of Cordell Hull really envisioning something as being definitely a new world order in line with what the New Deal was promising. So why don't you speak a bit more on that, on kind of, you know, Cordell Hull's unique position as a Cobdenite and you know, kind of creator of all this.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's, I guess, in leading up to the discussion of Cordell Hull, I suppose it'd be useful just again to emphasize that Cordell Hull's tariff revolution, as Alfred Eckes has referred to it, of the 1930s and early 1940s in the United States, you can't understand why it's a revolution along Cobdenite lines, again, without understanding that the United States looked very different before sure. that. Again, this is that GOP dominated protectionist era in which these free traders on the left, these anti-imperialists and peace activists of the book, are very much working on the outside looking in for the most part, with some very rare exceptions, say during the administrations of Grover Cleveland, for example. In fact, Cordell Hull got his political start. He's a Democrat from Tennessee. He got his start in politics, I think, at the age of 17. As a stump speaker for Grover Cleveland in 1888, who was running for re-election as president against the protectionist challenger, Benjamin Harrison. And again, even that, it was known as the Great Debate of 1888 between the pro-free trade Cobdenite Cleveland administration and the protectionist Republicans, who, you know, essentially whoever won that was going to dictate whether the United States would continue along that particular path when it came to engaging with the global economic system. And Harrison ended up winning, even though he loses the popular vote. But anyway, so the Cordell Hull gets his start within this conflict between free trade versus protectionism along Cobdenite lines in the late 19th century. And that is something else I increasingly came away with from this book, too, is that you can't understand the creation of this mid-20th century reordering of the United Nations period, of you know, Bretton Woods system, of World Trade Organization, what we call the World Trade Organization. You can't understand that without understanding the fact that the people who designed that came of age in the late 19th centuries and early 20th centuries. So that they are being, you know, they're being intellectually, you know, their ideas are being formed against this backdrop of this debate around protectionism or free trade of this period. And Cordell Hull starts off in the late 19th century as a free trader. This becomes even stronger. It's really he talks about this in his memoirs. It's what he takes away from the First World War. Here again is that example of this being a protectionist period leading up to the First World War, is that the First World War, the main cause of it was the growth of economic nationalism and the trade wars that had laid the geopolitical groundwork for the conflicts that ultimately became the First World War. And so it's that lesson, too, that he takes away. And so when he ends up getting appointed Secretary of State under Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1933, you suddenly have a Cobdenite in a position of power like we've really have never seen up until that point. And so all of these left-wing organizations and movements that I look at, it, one of the things I try to show here too, as you touched on, right, is this: is each of those chapters ends with how they end up getting behind Cordell Hull's attempts to turn the United States away from protectionism and to free trade. And so in various ways, they help and they become allies in very big ways in supporting Cordell Hull's efforts to liberalize American trade policy. And this is what he does. And so he is responsible from this perspective of turning the United States away from its protectionist path, its decades of protectionism and imperial politics, to something different, to something more anti-imperial, more pacifistic. This plays out in the good neighbor policy of Latin America under his State Department regime, a massive overhaul of the way the United States engages with or intervenes or doesn't intervene in Latin American affairs, independence of the Philippines, and of course, his role in the creation of the United Nations. So he gets two of his nicknames here, the Tennessee Cobden, as a result of his trade liberalization reforms and his efforts to create what would become the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade in 1947, and what we now think of as the WTO, but also the father of the United Nations because of his efforts to create a supranational structure to maintain a freer trading system that had more teeth than the League of Nations ever had, right? That was one of the big critiques of the League of Nations. That it was just, it just didn't have, of course, it also didn't have the United States in it to support it. And so it's because of Cordell Hull's kind of bringing Cobdenism to the United States in a big way the people that I look at in the book, at least, see this as they think that their Pax Economica is finally coming into being under because of Cordell Hull's reforms, because of the institutions he creates to maintain a freer trade system, getting the United States to take a lead role in a new supranational organizational structure. Things seem to be going their way. They felt like they had finally won the war, so to speak, the ideological war by the late 1940s. And then, of course, one of the things I try to show in the book, though, is that this is a very short-lived victory lap that they run, and then the onset of the Cold War, and the backdrop of decolonization, this seeming more peaceful interdependent world order starts to unravel very quickly.
Yeah, as far as it goes to the crack up, and the crack up, I mean, it's not one thing, but one aspect is just, as you say, the Pax Economica becomes a Pax Americana. It's a very polar world, as opposed to the idea of a completely flat, just every nation being kind of at equal standing. There is just an extinguishing of this kind of certainly a lot of the ideological space as well, as we just go into pick your side. You know, the Cold War is here, and I suppose there's many things that contribute to that, but it is the way you frame this is it surprised people. And I suppose, you know, is this a matter of the UN not getting nukes? Is this a matter of the UN not having more explicit power in other ways? But I don't know. I mean, do you think things could have turned a different way, or do you think that things were pretty constrained even at that vantage?
I mean, it's a really interesting question, and you know, what ifs that we could have. You know, what if the International Trade Organization, the kind of precursor to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, had actually gotten passed under the Truman administration, that it was attempted and failed, that was much more open to the demands of the decolonizing world.
Sure.
And whereas the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, while still there to create multilateralism and definitely led to a drastic drop of tariff rates amongst its signatories, with the United States leading the way, was not nearly as sympathetic to those demands coming from the increasingly decolonizing spaces around the world. So I think that's definitely a kind of a what if, you know, what if the ITO had come into existence instead of the GATT? But yeah, could they have, you know, avoided? I mean, the Cold War, I think lots of people deserve the blame for it, right? And for creating this kind of Manichaean divide, that the Soviet sphere deserves its fair share of the blame for creating that. But the United States, as the new leader under Cordell Hull, at least, we could, I guess, maybe if we're going to take that, what if Cordell Hull had not gotten as sick as he had, and he could have maintained his role as the Secretary of State for quite a bit longer, it would be interesting to think about whether he could have continued. He was very principled in many ways in the way he stuck to his guns here. But the United States, in that context of the Cold War, the paranoia, the way it so quickly turned away from this new period of multilateralism to unilateralism to militarism as the first action, a first resort. I struggle to see, without an entirely different cast of characters running the show in the United States, I struggle to see how it would have avoided that particular trend. Or perhaps, too, I mean, the Cold War kind of creates this rigidity and even in many ways pulls some from the left wing free trade camp further to the right during this period as they become more skeptical of socialism and any forms. And so the kind of the socialist internationalists and the capitalist free traders of the book that used to be allies are increasingly at loggerheads, aren't they? So, I mean, I guess if we were going to play that out, how different would the world have looked without the Cold War? I think that might be a fascinating one, right? How we could have avoided the Cold War is—I'll leave that to the Cold War scholars.
Yeah, it's always surprising how quickly things shifted. Like some folks that kept a pacifist line during World War II, like Norman Thomas. Yeah, that's a tough position to hold during World War II to maintain a pacifist. But even he became a supporter of the Korean War. A lot of other people, they were pacifists in World War II. They switched over, except for the completely hardline, kind of religious pacifists. And it's just so much of the space that even allowed, I'm neither here nor there. There is a third way. I think by 1950, these folks felt, okay, there is no space for the anti-Stalinist left. You have to still criticize the U.S. You have to throw in with the U.S. Henry Wallace would be the other example. Is that conciliation? Is that actually some sort of actual, multipolar? I don't know. They certainly saw it as conciliation.
And maybe this, so many of these stories too fall into that sort of, they're also getting older. And I do sometimes wonder about, we talk about, what is that saying? If you're not a liberal when you're 20, but if you're not a conservative by the time, like the idea that many people tend to get more conservative politically as they get older too. I can't
but somebody
help but
got
wonder
older in that 5-year span, they got old.
Yeah, I think too, maybe the Cold War really caught them by surprise as well. And they really thought that the Second World War finally was going to be the last war. And so perhaps it made them rethink some of their beliefs in the pacifistic elements of interdependence and multilateralism and the fact that so quickly the world order did become so Manichaean and did become so militant. Maybe that was part of it. I can't get in their heads as much as I would like on that question, but it's a really interesting question to think about. But I think probably it plays into the fact that just really 5 years from seeming to have everything in their grasp to everything just being just completely back to square one in many ways, that it must have led some to disillusionment.
One thing that's really interesting here is in the post-crack-up world, free trade takes root. Free trade has its benefits and its problems. But what's interesting is the problems, as it were, are almost in every case anticipated by the more idealistic left-wing proponents of free trade in the century before. You can say everything from the more religious elements are very consistent on having a kind of the social gospel of a welfare state and actually making sure that this kind of it is not the neoliberal order of some do very well and some are left in dire poverty. And I think the other aspect, I'd be remiss not to kind of underline this, is you talk about what is some of the main problems of the Cold War free trade order. And it is the third world being exploited. It is the the trade organizations, it doesn't make everyone happy, certainly if these places feel that they're being used for their resources. They have, you know, what is in practice an unequal trade. And this was something that certainly the Henry George aspect, you know, aspects of this we're talking about. It really has to do with if you want to have people who really get their due for wages and a thriving society, you have to have control of natural resources. And different aspects, not just them, but I you can talk about some of the everything from fair trade to the NIEO kind of pushing for a distributed source of kind of actual community control of resources. And compare that against a lot of the trade organizations. I remember if folks are going to join the EU, they would have to basically make it allowable for folks to buy up natural resources, because you can't join our trade organization unless everything is a commodity, which is it certainly flattens what's possible, and it's something that runs completely at ends with what a lot of these, you know, left-wing free traders were pushing for in the first place.
Yeah, it's a good point and good question. If you're looking at this, does in many ways go back to the left-wing free trade critique of colonialism and imperialism from the late 19th century onwards, the Hobsonian and Leninist critiques even of the early 1900s. This association that we touched on earlier of the protectionist politics, economic nationalism, creating the market inefficiencies at home,
yeah,
that create the either real or perceived need for finding new markets to send surplus capital. But to this point about natural resources, raw materials, as it was often referred to.
Exactly.
Exploiting those, right? That was the critique going back to the late 19th century, at least, of how protectionism led to colonialism. But you didn't need to do that, right? Under this idea, right, if you had global free trade, and an inefficient domestic marketplace, then that would get rid of this necessity to often coercively acquire new colonies. And then, of course, if you're trading peaceably with all the nations of the world, then you don't need large standing armies and navies. You don't need to spend all that money on militaries. You don't have the military conflict. But you also then don't have to worry about getting raw materials because you can just trade for them. Or as they increasingly become more skeptical that would work as it should, that's when you start seeing this left-wing support for supranational organizations as the way towards this. So the left-wing groups that I look at are adamant that the League of Nations and then the United Nations should take a lead role in distributing these raw materials and natural resources equitably to make sure, in many ways, it was mainly about food security. It was especially for the feminists in this story, there's enough food to feed the world. There's no reason that people should be starving. And clearly, if nations are left to their own devices, they will continue to perpetuate this cycle of hunger and food wars and so forth. This is why you need supranational structures and kind of a diminution of national sovereignty to a certain extent when it comes to natural resources, the necessities of life, to make sure that this doesn't happen ever again. So in many ways, it was, well, if you want to call it utopian, but free trade meets really, really strict supranational regulation of trade in ways that they did not find to be in conflict whatsoever, very different perhaps from the neoliberal vision of free trade that comes into being in a big way from the 1970s onwards, right? And this puts them at loggerheads. So you do have in the 1960s, one with the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development in 1964, and then with the NIEO in 1974, you have these growing demands from the decolonizing world, the global South, the third world, however you want to refer to it. But increasingly, and in contrast to previous generations, even with a lot of sympathy and support from the left-wing free traders who understand the demands of the decolonizing world, for that they do need a lift up. They do need to have perhaps even a certain amount of time to have protectionist policies to protect those different industries. At the same time, though, one of the fascinating things about that is that when you actually look at the decolonizing world's demands and their critiques of Western economic imperialism. I don't know about you, but whenever my understanding before I started digging into this book was the critique was of what we might now think of as neoliberalism, or it's going to be about free trade imperialism, you know, under the disguised under these supranational structures of the Bretton Woods system, like the World Bank and the GATS and so forth. But when you start digging into the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development or the NIEO, the main critiques that they have of the Western capitalist system and powers, the United States, of course, being the lead one here, is how these powers continue to practice protectionism.
Yeah.
At home. And it's their critique is actually that the West is not practicing what it's preaching. And in fact, what they're calling for is for free trade with the West. And it's actually the distortion is the continued economic nationalism. They're just hiding it a bit better, I suppose, in the United States and elsewhere in the West that they're critiquing here. So in many ways, it's the critique is still the same once you start getting into the 50s, 60s, and 70s. They're still critiquing the economic nationalist imperial politics of the West, not so much the free trade politics.
Yes, it's even the when you have commerce itself takes on a negative flavor with kind of more Marxian block, you still see a critique of the embargoes of Cuba, of the Soviet bloc at different points, and you can see the same thing with Gaza. I mean, I think even folks that I think you would be very surprised to make a full-throated appeal to commerce is good. Certainly, there is an intuitive response that when commerce is taken away as an option, it's bad. And it's kind of interesting ideologically how they make that even fit.
I mean, that Che Guevara, when he gives his speech at the inaugural meeting of UNCTAD in 1964 in Geneva, like, he might as well have just been paraphrasing Richard Cobden in his critiques of Western protectionism and the Cuban embargo that had just come into play, right, a couple of years before that. I mean, it's just remarkable, isn't it? And then, I mean, I think that's part of, you know, I don't think I have all the answers here. There's way more work needs to be done on this for the late 1900s and early 21st century. You know, exactly why it is that the left-wing free trade movement sort of peters out in many ways. Although I try to point out there's still some grassroots elements there with the fair trade movement and cooperative movement and so forth. But that for the most part, it's lost its driving force. And I think part of the reason is because what we kind of globalization becomes so closely associated with this kind of neoliberal version of it that the World Trade Organization becomes associated with, the United States becomes associated with. Both political parties are in favor of this sort of free market system that seems to care very little about labor protections, environmental protections, in ways that are antithetical to this left wing tradition, as is the penchant for military interventionism to help enforce this kind of free market system. This is obviously, this is antithetical to the kind of left-wing Cobdenite tradition that I look at. And so you see, my guess here is that from the 1990s onwards, it's increasingly difficult for people, left-wing internationalists, whether socialists or even liberal radicals, to get on board the liberalization gravy train that's taking place, because the version of free trade is not the version that they set out to acquire, and perhaps this pushes them further and further away from associating themselves with free markets. But also perhaps can be explained why many on the left seem to be rediscovering this desire for trade liberalization in the wake of all the kind of global events that have happened at least since 2016, right? With the U.S. turn towards protectionism, Brexit, Russian invasion of Ukraine, the blockade in Gaza and so forth. That perhaps it's been a reawakening for some on the left maybe this Pax Economica is having a bit of a moment right now.
Yeah, I think you. When you're looking at the reformers and on the left wing, it isn't just free trade. It is part of a package deal of free trade and democracy and resource justice. And I think you could see in the books when Henry George was writing about this, he writes a defense of free trade, but he even says, if you only do this and never do the resource justice, you'll still see unfull employment. You'll see, you know, different forms of poverty persist in misery. This is one step along a way to build towards, you know, kind of a society you want entirely, as opposed to, as you're saying, the more neoliberal approach. Some things you need, like free trade. Some things you can do without, like democracy. you might support some dictators, and as you say, like in places like Guatemala, Iran, Cuba, you know, if you are a left-wing reformer for resources, that puts you at odds, and you might just be deposed, even if this is, you know, exactly. I think you might say a lot of the pre-20th century reformers, I think, would have supported the justice of a lot of these kind of commandeering of resources for local use. But certainly that part was flattened in what was available in the discussion in the Cold War order.
We've touched a little bit on some of the principles of this kind of left-wing free trade tradition. Obviously, the food security, cheap food, perhaps being the most powerful one, especially for getting support from beyond the middle classes, getting the working classes to get behind it since the mid-19th century. But it was also, again, it's this close association with free trade as a democratizing force.
Yeah.
And a non-interventionist foreign policy to go with it. Right? That you shouldn't force free trade on anybody. That Cobden and his disciples are probably the most vocal opponents of the opium wars, of Britain's free trade imperialism in India and so forth. This is not how they envisioned free trade. It shouldn't be forced on anybody. People should want it because it's good for them, because they can see the benefits it's giving to Britain and want to emulate that. But yeah, it's the democratization of, and this ties into Henry George in a big way too, right? It's getting rid of the landed elites. Breaking up the land monopolies is such a big part of Cobden's own version of free trade. And this is, I think, a big inspiration on Henry George and his disciples as well, that he's drawing on here. It goes back to, remember, the corn laws, these protective tariffs on foreign grain. Who did this help? This helped the landowners who were growing grain in Britain, the aristocratic elites, and making the working classes, many of whom were moving into cities, urban areas, starving though in many ways. And so the promise here of getting rid of these protective tariffs on foreign grain so that nobody could ever go hungry in Britain ever again. But at the same time, it would undermine the economic power of the aristocratic landed elites by getting rid of these protectionist policies in a similar way that the Junkers were dominating German imperial politics in the late 19th century and elsewhere. They really saw this as a global phenomenon, this land, the land monopolies controlled by aristocrats, these militant aristocrats. So free trade as a democratizing force that will undermine the influence of aristocratic elites. This would then allow for the democratization of foreign policy. Getting rid of the economic influence of aristocrats would also mean potentially limiting their political influence. And so there was a very close association with free trade then as a democratizing force. This is what's also going to, I think, be attractive to women suffragists who become involved more with this kind of left-wing free trade movement from the First World War onwards, alongside the food security argument, women and children being the ones who often suffered the most from wars, even though they didn't have a say in causing them. And so that's where that plays out. But then, yeah, once we get to the neoliberal, this is a very important distinction too, between the left-wing free trade tradition that I look at here and the neoliberal one. Is this, you know, they maintain their adherence to free trade as a democratizing force, whereas the neoliberals become increasingly skeptical that democracies, especially left-wing democracies, can allow for the maintenance of this free trade system. And so the skepticism, if not downright opposition, as your examples point out, to democracies around the globe, and then using military interventionism to often overthrow them, to install right-wing dictatorships that are seen to be more reliable in maintaining a free trade system. This again is utterly antithetical to this left-wing version that I'm looking at here.
It's you talk about the feminist perspective. It's one thing that's kind of interesting from that perspective is a different point, certainly a full-throated, you might say, consumerist, you know, mindset of saying, which is a left concern, which I think is, if you talk about things that are flattened now, it almost goes without saying that consumerism is a right-wing concern, and being anti-consumerist is, you know, you might kind of expand this, like the Adbusters kind of mindset or something, but just the idea that, like, food security, you know, that's a consumerist concern. The ability to have people have their basic needs met. Consumerism, as it says, has this kind of, certainly this kind of framework of it's illegitimate or something. But I think that certainly a lot of these reformers were making, you know, it certainly is legitimate that people get their needs met.
Yeah, and I mean, from that perspective too, you know, who are the ones that are in a way most anti-consumerist during this different period, this late 1930s, 20th century period? It's the imperial protectionists.
Yeah.
Who are saying that we should be willing to pay more if it means maintaining our empires and expanding our empires. And so, yeah, the consumerist elements of this debate throughout this period largely falls on the left as the advocates for consumer rights and you know, again, food security being a big part and definitely a driving force behind the women's suffragist embrace of free trade as part, when they become essentially the suffragist wing of the international peace movement from the First World War onwards in a very big way. You also see it, though, too, with these kind of socialist third way movements that moderate socialist movements that embrace free trade principles along in many ways along cognate lines, like the cooperative movement. In fact, the cooperative movement, which is for the most part is a very consumer oriented, consumer protection oriented a movement, nonprofit, or that this, you know, essentially seeks to get rid of the middleman between producers and consumers. Essentially, everybody's a consumer, not everybody's a producer. They think that should be flipped around, and both the consumers should be their own producers, right, around the world. And you can do this through free exchange that gets rid of the profit motive on this kind of socialist version of communism. And of course, the cooperative movement got its start in Rochdale, England, which is kind of in the Manchester area, which is where the Anti-Corn Law League at the same exact time was centered. And so there's a lot of interesting political and ideological overlaps with those origin stories. And then the cooperative movement's going to pick up in a very big way too in the 1920s and 1930s. It's going to rival the labor union movement as probably the most numerical, at least in its subscribers. And its subscription as well to creating a cooperative framework of nonprofit free trade under this these cooperative principles that they're going to lobby the League of Nations to embrace. And they saw this as the only peaceful path forward. That they were kind of taking a different extreme and saying that the capitalist free traders were not taking into account the profit motive. And so this ties into, I think, a really interesting ways, the protections of consumers from the left in this time period. And of course, the cooperative movement is still very much with us too, even if it's perhaps forgotten some of this, its socialist origins or even its pacifistic origins today. How many of us end up shopping in co-ops all the time? And you can still see the sort of nonprofit drive that comes with that. If you become a cooperative member and get discounts on products or even have profit sharing methods, right? So anyway, yeah, to a very long-winded answer to the point that yes, consumer activism might now be associated more with this kind of right-wing narrative, but it was very much a driving point of the left-wing free trade tradition.
Yeah, it's interesting that you point out like the high tide of the co-op, you know, movement in the, you know, JFK administration, and it is framed as a way of it's balancing producers and consumers, and you could characterize protectionism as a way of favoring producers over consumers. Consumers lose, producers win, and I think the List response to this would be, yes, and that's good if that's what you want. And this also aligns with, you would say, the Soviet bloc. You know, it's an explicit strategy to essentially take away buying power from the people in order to have explicit state investment. And when you talk about the rising tide of kind of developing states in the 20th century, yes, it's the ability to invest is explicit. And I suppose just maybe one more thing to touch on would be the Hobson-Lenin intersection of how they viewed, you know, the imperialism of free trade. Hobson ideologically was quite distinct from what you'd see from the Soviets. In fact, he was a reformer, and you mentioned that there's the Marx Manchester School, the Marx
List,
the Marx List School. And I think both traditions, it does seem like the Marxist ideology does have a difficult job really full-throatedly coming down one side or the other, as far as, like, we'll still be anti-embargo, per se, based upon the context.
I mean, and of course, so does capitalism, right?
Yeah.
Capitalism is also riven in between the economic nationalist side of the debate, the Listian side versus the kind of that free trade divide, right? And a similar rift is happening within the Marxist tradition, maybe at a smaller scale because there's fewer of them, depending on the time frame. And then, of course, I think we're so kind of influenced by kind of Stalinist era economic policies. It's the kind of autonomous, you know, kind of autarkic kind of block that the Soviet system is perceived to become from the Stalinist era onwards, that it's perhaps easy for us to forget that there were a lot of Marxist internationalists before that saw the world economic order to look, they wanted to look very different than that. And in fact, we're quite critical of the Stalinist turn towards autarky. Karl Kautsky, of course, amongst others, very much opposed to this shift from trade liberalization to something very different, to protection. And I guess this gets into that wider issue too, of, you know, the Listians who would say, you know, yes, protectionism helps the producers at the, you know, while it hurts the consumers, right? And they'd say that's okay. And I think in a certain sense, maybe it depends on where you fall on the idea of nationalism, right? So if national consolidation and if you see the need for strong industries as a key to succeeding, to strengthening your nation, if you think that the nation state is the end all and be all, then you can embrace these ideas and self-sufficiency. I mean, in many ways, in ways that we're seeing now, this kind of this divide in politics in the United States and elsewhere between those who want to, you know, a new industrial policy and you know, for the American workers, and even though the American consumers are going to end up paying the price at the grocery stores, right? We're seeing it playing out today too. But yeah, but the Marxists were not all that different. And I mean, this is one of the things I had a lot of fun digging out is Marxist trade ideas. And of course, Karl Marx himself never really speculated much on his ideal socialist trade policies. He was very much
Is transitional.
That's right. I mean, I think that's another fun game to play, actually, is imagine if you had the socialist revolution around the world, the workers of the world united. What sort of trade wars would we have? What sort of tariffs would you lay when there's no nation state anymore? You know, I can't help but think that in his view, it would have been a kind of a globalist era of kind of distributive politics without the, but anyway, Karl Marx, though, you know, he weighs in on this while he's living in England at the height of the anti-corn law legislation, him and Engels. And Marx is much more reserved than subsequent Marxists in his embrace of free trade. He sees it as a small P progressive development of the capitalist system. Seeing what had happened in Britain, he just assumes that this is the next step, moving from mercantilism, protectionism of the early modern period to something new. And this is why he says the socialists of the world should support free trade, because it's speeding along capitalist evolution and thus speeding us along to the socialist revolution, and it's going to unite the workers of the world along the way. So it's he's not quite but his critiques of protectionism, though, are remarkably similar to the capitalists at this point, protectionism as in very militant terms of something that works against the nation that practices it, as well as its trade partners, in ways that the communists, I think, would have largely agree with. But jump forward 50 or so years, and you have all these theorists, Marxist theorists of imperialism, like Lenin, like Kautsky, Hilferding, Bernstein, and so forth. A lot of those caveats that Marx had are gone, and they're so much more full throated in their embrace of free trade as a more peaceful state. And they've, you know, in many ways, they've disassociated free trade from bringing about the socialist revolution, and have become much more cognite in their worldview. And I think in part that's because they saw this economic nationalist turn across the globe leading up to the First World War that they're responding to. And so they start increasingly seeing free trade as the more peaceful path for socialists as well as for capitalists. And this is why I explain this is why they start working so closely together with Georgists and others in the United States and elsewhere. by around the First World War, because they're increasingly aligned on this idea of free trade as a more peaceful and anti-imperial method for designing a global order. At the same time, you have these, maybe exception is the term at this point, but there are the Marxist nationalists.
Yeah,
right. There are the Marxist tradition at work here too. And what's fascinating about that is that they also fall into these camps. So these nationalist socialists in, say, France, or some in Germany, some in Britain, like the Fabians, like George Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw, who was in his early years a Georgist, who then becomes a socialist, but then becomes a socialist nationalist.
Yeah, I never read that about Shaw before. I didn't know he made that hard a turn. You know.
Yeah, and essentially he rewrites the Fabian Society, the socialist organization in Britain. He becomes sort of its mouthpiece by around 1900, in many ways, it's his turning the Fabian Society into a pro-protectionist, pro-British Empire organization, nationalist organization. His vehement condemnation of the free traders, the alliance between the liberal and the labor parties that he's witnessing, that he's pushing back against, that drives a lot of the socialist free traders out of the Fabian Society, like Bertrand Russell and others. Shaw is this kind of this Georgist turned Fabian defender of the British Empire and protectionism. But you see that play out in very interesting circumstances in France, in Germany, in the United States. The Marxist nationalists who become a part of the protectionist defense and of the imperial project. Fascinating.
So I think as we're wrapping up here, just one more kind of question. I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are. Is you talk about how the GOP is returning to what it was for so much of its history, as a, you know, it is not the neoliberal order. It is the nationalist protectionist Listian order. And I suppose what we're seeing so far from the opposition, certainly, you know, not only the United States under, you'd see Biden doing things to kind of incubate semiconductors and something, but also larger sorts of trade war on the table. You could see the same thing as far as like the UK Labour Party. Look at the way they were flat-footed in how to respond to Brexit. I think didn't have a coherent ideological response. And I suppose, you know, from your vantage now, what are you seeing as far as the left as it stands in the face of a neo right wing protectionist order? Are you seeing an evolution to respond into any of the other traditional responses to it from the left historically in the more Cobdenite sense? Is there perhaps a new place for them to evolve to respond, given it's a much different context? I'm kind of curious what you're seeing.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose within the context of Trump and Biden and Brexit too, so much of that has also been about something we haven't really touched on too much here, but immigration.
Yeah, right?
These free trade protectionist debates in many ways often fell also along the idea of liberal immigration policies and restrictive immigration policies that we're also seeing playing out too. That the anti-immigration aspect of this is remarkably similar to the late 19th, early 20th century as well. I continue to think through this. I mean, one of the things I find so fascinating about what we're seeing now, we can point to the similarities, but you know, it is also, I think, fascinating to think about the differences. And I don't just mean about how globalized the world is and what that means for an economic nationalist resurgence. But also, if you think about the United States and Britain were the main instigators of the more liberal economic system that came out of the Second World War, and were the lead defenders of that in many ways, from both the left and the right in many ways, at least at the top of the political spectrum for decades and decades. And so what's fascinating to me since 2016, if you think about like Britain, it finally abandoned free trade in 1932 after the rest of the world had effectively done that already in the face of the Great Depression. Up until that point, it was kind of the lone defender of a free trading system. And then the United States sort of steps into that and became the lead defender of the free trading system from the 1940s onwards, right? What's fascinating here is that the United States and Britain in 2016 signaled the retreat from that free trade system And they were the first in many ways to do it, right? They started the trend. And now we have, since it, we had it in 2020, we have it in 2024, we have both, you know, presidential contenders from the major parties running on protectionist platforms. And like you say, you know, Biden maintaining the trade wars with China and even sort of doubling down on some of them and developing his own industrial policies to kind of counteract this Brexit, Britain with its trade barriers that it created and the rising prices for British consumers. It's all there, right? And again, to me though, this is something new. We've never seen this in the modern period, having the two creators of the system signaling the retreat from it rather than maybe being the last to do so. And so exactly what that means, it creates a lot of question marks that I don't have great answers for, but I do wonder, and this goes back to that earlier point too, if this is the moment then perhaps where we're going to start seeing left-wing internationalists who, or, you know, people on the left who tend to associate themselves as internationalists, but didn't really know where they fit in the story. Starting to finally see themselves as aligning with this older left-wing internationalist tradition that Pax Economica recovers from a seemingly forgotten past. And so it's possible that this provides an interesting blueprint, the book here, the story that it tells. And it also, in a weird way, to a limited extent, a story of success after decades of failure. The way that the left ends up kind of working together, reaching across to create this more peaceful, interdependent order that's it seems to be kind of falling apart in front of us here. I do wonder if perhaps this will allow, or perhaps this kind of reaching across the spectrum politically is something that can happen again. That a new kind of left wing coalition that used to exist in the early 1900s. In this attempt to reshape the global economic system, we might see something similar. And again, the some of those organizations, the Fair Trade Movement, the Cooperative Movement, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, quite a few of these institutions and movements that I look at in the book, they're still around, right? So it maybe is just a matter of just rediscovering these ideas of capitalist peace theory that left-wing internationalists at least are going to find enticing. Although no doubt those who associate themselves more with the nationalistic trend will not be quite so enticed with what the book has to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, the UN is still around. Is the UN still inspiring in the same way? Or are people striving for a different sort of super national entity? I don't know. I think a lot of people, I think, maybe have been drowning in pessimism for generations or more, but I think people do have the appetite to build something new.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And so, yeah, if the United Nations is no longer fit for purpose, if the World Trade Organization is no longer fit for purpose, perhaps it's, you know, either they can be reformed from within to kind of return to their roots, to their original intent. Or perhaps they need to be replaced by something new. I just hope it doesn't take another world war for that sort of revolution of the supranational system to take place.
Well, thank you so much for the time. It's been a pleasure. The book is Pax Economica, Left-Wing Visions of a Free Trade World. Thanks again, Mark, so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful.
Cool. We have been talking to Mark William Palin all about Pax Economica, Left-Wing Visions of a Free Trade World. You can find this episode and all previous episodes of this radio program at the website seethecat.org. This is a presentation of KZSU, Stanford.